Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I am Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with questions surrounding the latest Israeli attack on Iran's covert nuclear program, which destroyed cascades of their newest centrifuges enriching uranium and could set back progress on producing fissile material for 9 months. In response, Iran has announced that it will enrich uranium up to 60%, way above the 3.67% allowed under the JCPOA nuclear deal the Biden administration is trying to revive through indirect talks underway in Vienna. Joining us is Mark Fitzpatrick, Associate Fellow and former Executive Director of the Washington-based America's Office of the International Institute for Strategic Studies, where he heads its Non-Proliferation and Nuclear Policy Program, focusing on proliferation, nuclear security, and disarmament. The former Acting Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Non-Proliferation and author of The Iranian Nuclear Crisis, Avoiding Worst-Case Outcomes, we'll discuss how Iran is a few months away from having enough fissile material for a bomb and what impact this latest sabotage will have on the talks in Vienna. Then we'll examine further the undeclared war between Israel and Iran and the extent to which those working on nuclear enrichment in underground facilities in Iran must be disconcerted by Israel's successful efforts to sabotage their work and set back their program, which presumably involves local actors working against the regime. David Albright, the founder and president of the Institute for Science and International Security, who was the first non-governmental inspector of Iraq's nuclear program, whose latest book is Iran's Perilous Pursuit of Nuclear Weapons, joins us to discuss whether, since one bomb could all but destroy Israel, and Israel in turn could wipe out every city in Iran, could deterrence work to prevent a nuclear exchange between the two countries? Then finally, we will speak with Jamie Metzl, a senior fellow for technology and national security at the Atlantic Council, who is among the authors of an open letter to the World Health Organization, organized by a group of scientists working virtually, who are concerned not enough research has been done looking into the possibility of a lab leak at the BSL Level 4 Wuhan Institute of Virology, which contains the largest collection of coronaviruses in the world. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org, as either the Pacifica network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now is Mark Fitzpatrick, who is an Associate Fellow and former Executive Director of the Washington-based America's Office of the International Institute for Strategic Studies, where he heads the International Institute of Strategic Studies Non-Proliferation and Nuclear Policy Program, focusing on proliferation challenges and on nuclear security and nuclear disarmament issues. He served as a U.S. Foreign Service officer and was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Non-Proliferation. And his books include Overcoming Pakistan's Nuclear Dangers and The Iranian Nuclear Crisis, Avoiding Worst-Case Outcomes. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Fitzpatrick.
Happy to speak with you, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Mark. And obviously, this sabotage attack on Natanz, which was clearly highly sophisticated, has apparently caused quite a bit of damage. It happened when the U.S. Secretary of Defense was literally meeting with Netanyahu in Israel. A lot of analysts think there's a political dimension to it, and that is that the Israelis are trying to prevent Biden from going ahead to try and resuscitate the JCPOA agreement, the P5 plus 1 agreement with Iran, which they are negotiating through intermediaries now as we speak in Vienna. So let's just focus on the technical stuff at the moment. My understanding is that there was a new generation of centrifuges being employed, and through some kind of cyber method, the Israelis were able to sabotage them. And this is not the first time that this happened. There was an earlier apparently incident where a whole cascade of centrifuges had crashed. So I guess if I were in Iran working on a nuclear program, I would be very nervous, because these attacks are very sophisticated. They don't have fingerprints. They don't cause deaths except for the killing of their top nuclear scientist. So is this making Iran very nervous, do you think?
Oh, I'm sure it's making Iran nervous and quite angry. You know, and they responded very quickly to try to regain the negotiation leverage that some hawks in the United States and Israel thought was achieved by setting back their enrichment program. You know, Iran quickly announcing they would go to 60% enrichment, which is certainly within their capabilities. It should be noted, by the way, you mentioned that Iran was testing more advanced generation centrifuges. Iran has been rolling out one new generation after another. Most recently, just a day before this attack on Iran's annual nuclear day, they announced the introduction of a ninth generation centrifuge. I'm not sure, you know, how far along Iran is in perfecting these new generations. The fact that they have introduced so many new ones suggests that they haven't found one that works to their satisfaction. But they are making a good progress. And just the last note here, in response to your very clear introductory remarks, you know, a decade ago, when Israel and the United States tried to set back Iran's program by means of a cyber attack called Stuxnet, it put about 1,000 of Iran's centrifuges out of commission. And you know, there was anticipation that this really set back Iran's program, and it did, but only for about a year. Iran was able to replace all of those broken centrifuges within a year and carry on. And I expect that again today. How many centrifuges were broken during this power outage, I don't know, but I'm sure many were thrown out of kilter. Iran will be able to reestablish it. Some Israelis say 9 months setback, as you noted. Well, 9 months is not that long. Iran can bring them back.
Well, apparently these centrifuges, they're vertical, and they're sitting on a motor that spins them at 78,000 revolutions per minute. So if you throw them off kilter, I imagine it's quite a disaster. And they have these cascades of hundreds of them, don't they, in rows?
Yeah, each cascade has several dozen connected together in rows. And you're right, they spin at supersonic speeds. So when they are abruptly halted, they go out of kilter, is my layman's term of saying that they really get out of balance, and the internal mechanisms can easily break. And getting them back in balance takes a good deal of time. Now, what Iran can do is substitute good centrifuges that they have in storage. You know, in 2015, the Iran deal removed about two-thirds of their centrifuges, put them in storage. So they have those good ones there. They can just bring them back and replace the ones that were broken. That's why I'm saying it doesn't set them back all that long a period of time.
So let's then talk about, Mark Fitzpatrick, what Iran has in terms of weapons-grade material, fuel for a bomb. They've just announced that they're going to go to 60% purity from the 20%. Under the agreement that Donald Trump tore up, they were only allowed to enrich uranium up to 3.67%. So where are they in terms of the 90% necessary for a bomb?
Okay. So Iran, before the deal was struck in 2015, had gotten up to nearly 20%. 20% is regarded as the dividing line between low-enriched uranium and high-enriched uranium. And in principle, anything over 20% is bomb usable. But at 20%, you need a whole lot of it. most people say that 90% or 85 or 90% is what you really need for a bomb. You could do it at 60%, and that's why Iran's announcement is very worrisome. You know, Iran has no civilian purpose for 60% uranium. They've talked about using it to power ships or submarines. They don't have any ships or submarines that are nuclear powered. It would be many years before they could develop them. So this is, you know, obviously just a negotiation ploy to try to tell Iran's negotiation partners that if they don't get on with restoring the JCPOA, that Iran does have, you know, levers of its own to try to regain some sense of urgency on the part of America and others, that if they don't move quickly, Iran is going to be closer to being able to develop a nuclear weapon. You know, Iran does not today have a nuclear weapon. They could produce, you know, enough highly enriched uranium for a nuclear weapon before this latest attack on Natanz. They could do that within a little under 3 months. Now it would take longer because these centrifuges have to be rebalanced and replaced. And so maybe it takes 9 months. But that's just to produce the fissile material. Iran would still have to convert that highly enriched uranium to metallic form, form it into a pit for a bomb, and then do all the other physics things necessary to create a nuclear weapon. So it's not that they're within a few months of building a nuclear weapon itself.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Fitzpatrick, as an associate fellow and former executive director of the Washington-based America's Office of the International Institute for Strategic Studies, where he heads its Non-Proliferation and Nuclear Policy Program, focusing on proliferation challenges and on nuclear security and nuclear disarmament issues. He served as a U.S. Foreign Service officer and was acting Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Non-Proliferation, and his books include Overcoming Pakistan's Nuclear Dangers and the Iranian Nuclear Crisis, Avoiding Worst-Case Outcomes. So we've discussed the Iranian potential for fuel for a bomb and that the possibility that they could be 3 months away from having one, but they would also, of course, need, as you point out, a lot more knowledge of how to build a bomb. My understanding is that they did get blueprints of a Pakistani bomb of Chinese origin from AQ Khan's network. So is that your understanding, and how quickly? I mean, it's just one thing to have a blueprint. It's another thing to build a bomb.
Yes, indeed. Iran is thought to have obtained the bomb blueprints via the black market or Abdul Qadir Khan. But having the blueprint is one thing, and then devising the bomb is another, especially for doing it the first time. You know, the United States in the Manhattan Project got a bomb pretty quickly, and they, you know, poured all the resources of a rich nation into it with thousands of scientists involved. Iran would have to do it with a much smaller budget, a much smaller coterie of scientists, some of who have been killed by assumed Israeli assassinations over the past decade, and under the scrutiny of the world's intelligence agencies and the International Atomic Energy Agency based in Vienna. So it's no easy trick. Now, Iran did a lot of the development work for a weapon back in the early part of this century. All the documents that Israel discovered and purloined from Iran in January 2019 showed a lot of work on weapons development, but it was all thought to be blueprint work and design work and not actual work building the bomb. So we don't know exactly how far Iran got in being able to build a bomb, but my assumption is that it could be, take at least a year to build an actual bomb. And some in Israel have recently said it would take 2 years. And, you know, and those who said it, you know, may have more access to the intelligence information than I have, because I have none.
Well, again, you've got to, if you're an Iranian nuclear scientist or a technician working in these underground facilities at Natanz and elsewhere, you've got to be nervous. I mean, going back to Stuxnet, that was inserted into their systems in ways that would probably require some inside help. And the same would be true of this latest attack. And then you've got their top scientist being assassinated by a satellite-controlled machine gun on a roadside. My God, the sophistication of the Israelis is pretty impressive and quite deadly. Oh. And of course, we know that there's a low-scale maritime war going on between Israel and Iran, with setting limpet mines on various ships. The Iranians, an Iranian ship off the coast of Yemen, which is in support of the Houthis, was recently hit with some mines, and Israeli ships have been hit with rockets, and an Iranian tanker deliberately on its way to deliver oil to Syria deliberately created an oil spill off the coast of Israel, which the tides actually took it to the southern Lebanon and spoiled a nature reserve there. So what seems to be going on here is quite a dangerous game. But just back to the politics in the last minute here, Mark, how much is this designed, do you think, on the part of Netanyahu and his supporters here in the United States to prevent Biden from reviving this deal? And can it be revived under these conditions?
Okay, so first of all, I don't think that stopping diplomacy was the first motivation behind this attack on Natanz. The planning of that attack would have taken time. It was a very sophisticated attack, as you said. That cannot be done overnight. So I don't think, let's assume Israel was behind it. I don't think they could have known that negotiations would have begun in Vienna just a week ago and that they would have progressed to this point. Nor would they have known probably that Defense Secretary Austin would be visiting Israel. That was serendipitous or choose another adjective. The main motivation behind this attack was to stop Iran's progress, to stop it from moving closer to a nuclear weapons capability, and it was quite effective. As you've indicated, Israel has a quite an advantage, technological and espionage advantage over Iran in this ongoing undeclared war. Israel seems to be able to operate with in impunity. There are a couple other things that they've done against the nuclear program which you haven't mentioned. You could add to the list. So yeah, Iran has to be very nervous. And so the result is that Iran will move more of its nuclear facilities underground, not just buried underground, but away from any prying eyes. I think they no longer will want to declare everything to the IAEA. And of course, they had some things they never declared, and the IAEA is finding out about it. But Iran will have an incentive to be more secretive. Now, will it impact the talks? Undoubtedly. Iran is sending its team of negotiators back to Vienna to continue the talks. But undoubtedly, they will carry a more hardline position, a more inflexible position. For these talks to succeed, Iran is going to have to change its demands. They've demanded that every single sanction that Donald Trump imposed has to be removed. Trump imposed 1,500 or more sanction designations. Most of them will be removed, but some of them were for things like human rights violations against the prisons and the officials involved in killing hundreds of demonstrators in November 2019. That has nothing to do with the nuclear program, and there's no reason those sanctions should be removed. But if Iran says they've all got to be removed, well, I think there's going to be an impasse. And so, as I say, I don't think that was Israel's main motivation. Their motivation was to stop the program, to impede the program. But if Israel is able also to impede diplomacy, well, it's a 2-4 for Israel. Will it succeed? I still think that diplomacy will survive because all the parties negotiating in Vienna, the United States, Iran, or the Europeans, Russia, and China, they all want to restore the nuclear deal. And it's a matter of how much to pay for it. And I think they will find their way forward, but the path will be more difficult now.
Well, Mark Fitzpatrick, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
I'm very pleased to speak with you. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Mark Fitzpatrick, who's an associate fellow and former executive director of the Washington-based America's Office of the International Institute for Strategic Studies, where he heads the International Institute for Strategic Studies Non-Proliferation and Nuclear Policy Program, focusing on proliferation challenges and on nuclear security and nuclear disarmament. He served as a U.S. Foreign Service officer and was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Non-Proliferation. And his books include Overcoming Pakistan's Nuclear Dangers and The Iranian Nuclear Crisis, Avoiding Worst-Case Outcomes. We're going to take a brief station break and back, examining further the undeclared war between Israel and Iran. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from Germany is David Albright, who is the founder and president of the Institute for Science and International Security, a non-profit, non-partisan institution dedicated to informing the public about science and policy issues affecting international security. He was associated with the International Atomic Energy Agency's Action Team, and in 1996 became the first non-governmental inspector of Iraq's nuclear program, and he's written extensively on the subject of nuclear weapons and their proliferation in Peddling Peril, How the Secret Nuclear Trade Arms America's Enemies, and his latest book out soon is Iran's Perilous Pursuit of Nuclear Weapons. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Albright.
Good to be here.
So, David, there seems to be a sort of disconnect here between what the United States officials are saying in terms of Iran's breakout capabilities to acquire a nuclear weapon. They're talking about within 3 months. But on the Israeli side, they're saying they're, you know, at least a year away. And now that there's been this sabotage at Natanz of these cascades of centrifuges, now they're even saying that that could delay them by 9 months, although I believe they've got centrifuges in storage. So why is the U.S. saying Iran could have a bomb a lot sooner than the Israelis are saying? And the Israelis are the one that seem to be dedicated to preventing Iran from a breakout.
Well, the main reason is they're talking about different things. It's a little bit like comparing apples to oranges. The U.S. statement is about how long would it take Iran to get enough weapon-grade uranium for a bomb, and that's 3 months. Again, before this recent attack on Natanz, 3 months, and actually coming down because of increases in Iran's nuclear activities. When the Israelis have talked about a longer period of time, they're really talking about, well, how long would it take Iran to actually build a nuclear weapon? And the estimates vary in Israel. The military intelligence a couple months ago said that it would take Iran 2 years to have a deliverable nuclear weapon. And that assumes this shorter breakout timeline of about 3 months. Maybe they would have said 5 months, but the 3 month is really a worst case. And so with the Israelis in doing their estimate, it's an estimate of how long would it take Iran to put a nuclear warhead on a ballistic missile. And that takes longer than the time to produce enough weapon-grade uranium for a bomb. And so if let's say you say, okay, U.S. at 3 months to get enough weapon-grade uranium for a bomb, maybe Israel's 4 or 5 months, the Israelis would still say, okay, it's still going to take all of 2 years to get a warhead on a ballistic missile. And it's truly a challenge to do that. Where I think the Israeli estimate is a bit misleading is that that's probably not what Iran's going to do. Iran is probably, if it's going to build nuclear weapons, would build a device it could test underground, like North Korea did and India did. And so if you look at how long would it take to build a device to be able to test underground, it's probably closer to 6 to 9 months, where still the amount of time needed to make enough weapon-grade uranium is 3 months. So I think it's very important to keep in mind of what exactly is being talked about. And the traditional way of talking about breakout is just to get enough material for a bomb. And then you have to consider how long would it take to build a bomb. Now, if Iran just wanted a bomb it could put on a ship or a truck and send it someplace and then detonate it, a kind of a terrorist bomb or a last resort bomb, probably could do that in 6 months or less if it could get enough material for a bomb in 3 months. So these estimates differ quite a bit. But again, it is important to keep the context in mind. Now, the breakout timeline is a measure that's been accepted as the threat that the Iranian nuclear program presents. And it's a quantity that can be calculated by anybody. The trouble with the estimates to the how long does it take to get to a bomb is that they vary widely. You know, the French told me a couple of years ago, Iran could build a bomb in 3 months. So, you know, that I don't know how they factor in the amount of time needed to get enough weapon grade uranium. But let's be conservative. Let's say it's 3 months plus 3 months. It's 6 months. And so, but the problem is, what is the basis for those estimates of how long it takes to build the bomb? And the answer is, they're very qualitative and a lot of uncertainty and a lot of disagreements about the time. The breakout timeline of how much time it takes to build weapon-grade uranium or produce enough weapon-grade uranium for a bomb are estimates that anyone can do with a little bit of training. And they can be compared. So the estimate of how much time to produce weapon-grade uranium has become used to judge the threat posed by Iran's nuclear program, because it's like an experiment that can be duplicated, and so you can understand what it means. Where the time to make the bomb is extremely different. I had a former senior Israeli intelligence official. In fact, he led military intelligence for several years, tell me that his people used to come in and tell him, you know, it's 2 years to have a missile deliverable nuclear weapon. Others would say it's, you know, 6 months to 9 months. And he could never tell the difference in the sense of being able to judge which is right and which is wrong. And his estimate recently that he did it as an outsider was that it's about a year for Iran to have a deliverable nuclear weapon.
And again, I'm speaking with David Albright, who is in Germany. He's the founder and president of the Institute for Science and International Security, a nonprofit, nonpartisan institution dedicated to informing the public about science and policy issues affecting international security. He was associated with the International Atomic Energy's Action Team, and in 1996 became the first non-governmental inspector of Iraq's nuclear program. And he's written extensively on the subject of nuclear weapons and their proliferation in Peddling Peril, How the Secret Nuclear Trade Arms America's Enemies. And his latest book out soon is Iran's Perilous Pursuit of Nuclear Weapons. But the question that's not asked here, David, and even if the Iranians resorted to, you know, putting a crude bomb on a ship and, you know, ramming the coast in Tel Aviv, obviously they would never go after Jerusalem, but Tel Aviv might be their target. If they were to do that, wouldn't the Israelis obliterate Iran? And just literally every Iranian city would be vaporized.
Yeah, I think they would. And Israel certainly feels deterrence is necessary, but they're not totally sure. And I think that's why you see concerted and almost ongoing efforts to set back Iran's nuclear program, particularly its sensitive nuclear program. And the tactics have ranged from blowing up facilities, as the recent explosion at the Natanz, explosion last summer of a very dangerous centrifuge assembly facility for advanced centrifuges, to killing of the father of Iran's nuclear program, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, last December, assassinations of several senior leaders of the nuclear weapons program back in 2010 and 2011. So I think there is a sense, yes, Iran can be deterred. There's doubt if that is foolproof. And there's a sense also in Israel that it wouldn't take more than one nuclear weapon to destroy the state. I'm not sure a ship hitting, let's say, the coast of Tel Aviv, coastline or the beaches of Tel Aviv would do it. But if one was detonated a little bit inland, it could have a devastating impact. And so there is a great deal of worry that one could be enough. And so, and that's why I think you see Israel knows that there's a deterrent there, doesn't trust that it'll work, and therefore doesn't want to face the prospect of Iran being extremely close to nuclear weapons or having them. And what is close? I mean, if Iran can break out and get enough weapon-grade uranium in a matter of a month, is able to make a bomb, whether it's tested underground or delivered by a ship or delivered by a missile, if that starts to reduce down less than a year as it is, then I think there's a lot of worry. And I think that's partly why you see these activities happening in Iran.
Well, does this mean then that the assumption is that the Iranian leadership is not rational, that they're apocalyptic? I mean, I know the supreme leader believes that he talks directly to God. That's a little unsettling. But even with North Korea, as much as there have been fears about Kim Jong-un, he seems still to be reasonably rational. So is the assumption that...
I don't know if I would view North Korea as rational. If you look at all the episodes of violence, the shelling of innocent people by North Korea on the South Korean island, the sinking of a South Korean ship, I think North Korea is very unstable and unpredictable, but North Korea is surrounded by very powerful nations, none of which, regardless of their positions on denuclearization or arms control, want to see North Korea able to use its nuclear weapons. And so you have constant pressure on them to restrain themselves. No one has found any form of that's able to restrain the Iranian leadership from doing essentially what it wants. I mean, their activities are limited by pressure, but they still operate in Syria. They're still funding Hezbollah. They're supporting the Houthis. They are pursuing their nuclear capabilities quite aggressively, and they fight like crazy when you try to limit them. And an evidence of that is this nuclear deal, the JCPOA. It's a very weak deal. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, it limits their program for some number of years. When Trump walked away from it, it didn't take them long once they started to build back their program, where breakout timelines decreased down to a few months. So it was very quick they were right back to where we were. The JCPOA would legitimize their centrifuge program. If you're worried about the breakout timelines now, you should be absolutely terrified of what the breakout timelines would be if the JCPOA plays itself out and we get to 2030. So at that point, the program would be legitimized and Iran would be even stronger. And the breakout timelines would be much less than they are today and diminishing. And so you have a JCPOA that is pretty weak. You combine that with inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency that have done very poorly at being able to monitor and inspect the military sites, the places where they worked on nuclear weapons. We know now that Iran does have undeclared uranium. The inspectors have proven that. And yet Iran still resists pressure to come clean about that. And so you're in a situation where the arms control has failed to deliver its promise to block Iran's pathways to the bomb. It just delayed Iran's pathways to the bomb. It didn't deliver on showing that Iran has a peaceful nuclear program. It's failed utterly on that. And the IAEA says every 3 months they've been unable to certify that there aren't undeclared activities or facilities. And now they can actually say, yeah, there are undeclared materials that violate the fundamental non-proliferation deals. Sure. So you have a situation where the U.S. effort just isn't cutting it. And I think if what happens then is that countries start to act on their own to try to limit Iran's activities and to try to, if you can't do that to arms control, economic pressure, then you don't want to have a war. You really don't want to have a war. Then you start to do things like what I think Israel's been doing, targeting things very precisely to limit their capabilities and to make it so it's not 3 months to the bomb anymore. You know, we don't know the damage assessment yet. Evidently, many centrifuges were destroyed at Natanz's attack, so the breakout timeline will go up.
But, David, just in the last couple of minutes here, I can't imagine that the Biden administration are trying to revive the old JCPOA that you say was insufficient. Surely they want to negotiate one that would work. So just in the last minute here, do you think you could make a deal with Iran that would work?
I think you can. But the Biden administration is trying to revive the JCPOA. They're thinking, let's get the JCPOA in place and then sit down with Iran to negotiate a stronger JCPOA. But the sanctions have been given up at that point. And so I think what we're headed toward is probably Iran will negotiate for years and not give in much at all while the JCPOA plays out and Iran is able to build up its centrifuge program. So I think what I thought when the Biden administration came in and there were some statements is they would try to negotiate a better deal while rejoining the JCPOA. And maybe they will, but the signals they've been sending are not that. And you have editorials in the New York Times calling for, you know, it only makes sense to go back to the JCPOA. That the editorial is deeply flawed in its logic. But there's a momentum building up that it's time to get the JCPOA back. But the problem with it is that it requires the United States to get rid of a lot of the sanctions. And it'll require the United States to go to Israel and say, stop this bad behavior, Israelis. And I think Israelis this time may not be willing, which means Iran probably will not abide by any JCPOA. And just after this explosion, it came out and said, today, we're going to go up to 60% enriched uranium right away. So and this gets back to the alliance regime is extremely reactive and hard to predict. But it never predicts on the side of moderation and restraint and compromise.
Well, David Albright, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Albright, who's the founder and president of the Institute for Science and International Security, a non-profit, non-partisan institution dedicated to informing the public about science and policy issues affecting international security. He was associated with the International Atomic Energy Agency's Action Team and in 1996 became the first non-governmental inspector of Iraq's nuclear program. And he's written extensively on the subject of nuclear weapons and their proliferation in Peddling Peril, How the Secret Nuclear trade arms America's enemies, and his latest book out soon is Iran's Perilous Pursuit of Nuclear Weapons, and he joined us from Germany. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into the possibility of a lab leak at the BSL Level 4 Wuhan Institute for Virology, which contains the largest collection of coronaviruses in the world. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Jamie Metzl, who's a leading futurist, geopolitical expert, science fiction novelist, and senior fellow of the Atlantic Council, who has served in the White House, State Department, and the United Nations. In February of 2019, he was appointed to the World Health Organization's Expert Advisory Committee on Developing Global Standards for the Governance and Oversight of Human Genome Editing. And he's written A History of the Cambodian Genocide, an historical novel, The Depths of the Sea, and genetics and sci-fi thrillers, Genesis Code and Eternal Sonata. And his latest book is Hacking Darwin, Genetic Engineering and the Future of Humanity. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jamie Metzl.
Thanks so much, Ian. Happy to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And you are among a group of signatories to a letter that was organized by a group of scientists who have been meeting virtually, discussing the possibility of a lab leak at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. I take it the letter you wrote, which is calling for further action to find critical records and biological samples that could provide essential insights into pandemics origins, remain inaccessible. The letter, I take it, was written to the WHO?
So it was an open letter, and there were two open letters that were written to really the world. Obviously, we're very mindful of the WHO. We're mindful of the Chinese government, which has massively restricted access, and the governments around the world that are representing people everywhere who are stakeholders. We are all stakeholders in understanding how this terrible crisis began so that we can prevent the next one.
Well, the WHO did have a delegation that the Chinese sort of monitored, I guess, that recently did an inspection of the origins and were at Wuhan. There was dissatisfaction with the results, and later the head of the WHO admitted that maybe there should be further investigations into a lab leak. In the course of the announcement of what they found, they added to the list of possibilities that the virus could have begun with frozen seafood that was imported into Wuhan or into China. And that seemed to me pretty much like it was so unlikely that it felt like that to some extent they had kowtowed to China, because that clearly seemed to be something that the Chinese government was interested in putting into the report in order to get off the hook, if you will.
Yeah, so there's a small misperception in your question, and I don't blame you, because most people on Earth are confused about this point, because it was in pretty much every media account of this what is called a WHO investigation, which was neither the WHO nor was it an investigation. The entity that did the February 9th press event in Wuhan and then released their report a couple of weeks ago wasn't the World Health Organization. It was an independent advisory committee to the WHO, but not the WHO itself. And Dr. Tedros, the WHO Director General, has made clear, he's asked, why are people calling this the WHO? This is this independent committee. And then they were working in conjunction with their Chinese government counterparts. And so what they announced at the press event in Wuhan, what they later issued in their report, was a consensus among this independent committee and their Chinese government counterparts. And it wasn't an investigation, because by their own admission, they didn't have the mandate to do an investigation. And then within that, they said they didn't have a mandate to even in any serious way look at the possibility of a lab accident as one of the very valid, in my view, hypotheses for how this terrible pandemic began. And so when Dr. Tedros said, no, we need to fully examine all hypotheses, including a lab incident, it wasn't that the WHO was suffering from some kind of autoimmune disease. It was that Tedros and the WHO, I think, are deeply committed to a full investigation into what happened. And sadly, most people will be surprised to hear that more than a year and a half, or all nearly a year and a half after the outbreak, there's no investigation into the no full investigation into the origins of the pandemic. And certainly it was unbelievably shameful in February, and outrageous, frankly, in February, on February 9th at the Wuhan press event, where they said without any serious consideration that the possibility of an accidental lab leak shouldn't even be investigated. And then this far-fetched, but I guess it's conceivable hypothesis that it just showed up in Wuhan through some kind of cold chain or frozen food. That got thrown in as though that's highly credible and worthy of full investigation. But the lab leak hypothesis, which in my personal view is probably the most likely possibility, but still only a possibility, was deemed not even worthy of further study.
Well, it does seem, Jamie Mitchell, that the Chinese government, at the very least, is sensitive, because going back to early in the COVID pandemic, Australia and some other countries suggested an international investigation through the WHO, and China got furious and actually put pretty severe sanctions, trade sanctions on Australian wine and other agricultural products.
Yeah.
So clearly they're sensitive, right?
It's a really great point, Ian. I mean, they're extremely sensitive, and that's why China is bending over backwards to try to say, hey, this was either from animal to animal jump in the wild or through frozen food, and doing absolutely everything possible from day one to prevent even the most basic consideration of whether this could have been an accidental lab leak. And so from day one, they started scrubbing social media, they started destroying samples, they started hiding records, they imprisoned citizen journalists who asked the most basic questions about this possibility, and very, very early on established a gag order preventing Chinese scientists from saying or writing anything about the origins of the pandemic without prior government approval. And you can understand why such a secretive government is so sensitive, because if this happened through accidental, something that happened in the wild, you can't blame China for nature. But if this is the result of a lab error followed by a very, in my view, kind of sinister cover-up, but that's pretty bad. I mean, it's the difference between getting cancer from sun exposure and getting cancer from Chernobyl. If you get cancer from sun exposure, what are you going to do? Be mad at the sun? If you get cancer from Chernobyl, you actually know who you should be mad at.
And again, I'm speaking with Jamie Mitchell, who's a leading futurist, geopolitical expert, science fiction novelist, and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, who has served in the White House, the State Department, and the United Nations. In February of 2019, he was appointed to the World Health Organization Expert Advisory Committee on Developing Global Standards for the Governance and Oversight of Human Genome Editing. And he's written A History of the Cambodian Genocide, an historical novel, The Depths of the Sea, and genetics and sci-fi thrillers, Genesis Code and Eternal Sonata. And his latest book is Hacking Darwin, Genetic Engineering and the Future of Humanity. And of course, we have to be careful when we refer to China or Chinese, because we don't want to fall into Donald Trump's racist kind of off-the-cuff remarks about China, conflating Wuhan and the Chinese virus with the Chinese people. We've always got to point out that we're talking about the Communist Party government of the People's Republic of China.
It's sorry to interrupt you, Ian, but it's such an important point. I mean, I'm a progressive. I've been a human rights campaigner my entire life. I lived in Cambodia doing human rights work for the United Nations. I'm deeply committed to social justice in the United States, where I live, and around the world. So, and I condemn now and condemned then the just disgusting, inflammatory, racist rhetoric and actions, frankly, of Donald Trump and in many cases, in some cases, his administration more broadly. And there's no doubt that Trump was using his criticism of China and the WHO to try to deflect blame from the catastrophic and devastating failure of his administration. Having said all of that, though, we need to understand how this pandemic began, and we need to be science-driven and data-driven and honest and fearless and do it in a way that is not racist, but it's honest. And it would be the inverse can't be true because we're afraid that some people might abuse. Let's just say hypothetically, we find out that that this pandemic started because of an accidental lab accident followed by a cover-up. But we're so afraid of even examining that question because we think, well, if it's proven, that may give fodder for some kind of racists. If we do that, what happens to the scientific method? But also, how can we prevent and work to prevent the next crisis? Because we need to know how this terrible pandemic started, just like we need to know why an individual plane crashes, because if we don't understand why one plane crashed, there could be another plane with that same problem that's already in the air. If we don't understand how this pandemic started, we could very easily face another pandemic, possibly starting the same way at some point in the future.
So we've talked about how the Communist Party government of the People's Republic of China have used propaganda and distraction. They're obviously sensitive about even looking into the origins of the COVID pandemic, but they've been helped in some extent by starting back in February of last year in the journal, medical journal, The Lancet. There were articles suggesting that anybody that didn't buy the zoonotic leap theory were indulging in fear, rumors, and prejudice and conspiracy theories. And you've mentioned that in the New York Times article recently, that it became career suicide for scientists to voice suspicions about a lab leak. But nevertheless, when you look at the Wuhan Institute of Virology at level BSL level 4 institute, it does have the world's largest collection of coronaviruses in the world. And one of the theories that I've heard, and you know, I've spoken to Lawrence Gostin and Glenn Cohen at Harvard, and Ian Lipkin, of course, was one of the first people I talked to when it first began, and Josh Rogan of the Washington Post has been looking into it. There is a lot to look into, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. And you mentioned this Lancet letter from February of 2020. The reason why I very early on in January, February of 2020 started raising these questions is because, as you mentioned in your intro, I have a science background. I have a China background. As someone with a science background, I felt I understood pretty well what was happening and how dangerous it was. And as someone with a China background, I knew what had happened with the memory of the 47 million people who died as a result of Mao's terrible practices and policies and actions. I knew that when the first Chinese speed train crashed, they dug a big hole and threw it in the hole and hoped nobody would notice. So for me, when I started to see this evidence emerging, first of that the outbreak happened in Wuhan, where they don't have horseshoe bats, but they do have China's, as you mentioned, only level 4 virology institute. When I started to see that China was so aggressively pushing the story that the pandemic, the outbreak started in the wet market in Wuhan, where it was just very clear by late January 2020 that was a lie and that China was aggressively pushing out this kind of lie. And then I hope I can use this language. It just pissed me off when I saw that Lancet letter, no matter how many Nobel laureates they had because signing it, because I felt, well, there's a really serious issue. Outbreaks have begun with zoonotic jumps from animals to humans in quote unquote in the wild. So we know that's a possibility. But the possibility that this started with a lab incident, even then, that was very real. Now it seems even more possible. And that these scientists and very, very well respected people in the earliest days of the pandemic with no evidence were saying, we know it's this, and anybody who even asks a basic question is a conspiracy theorist. It was so kind of fundamentally insulting to the scientific process, to the basic tenets of objective inquiry. That really inspired me. So in early last year, I started writing and speaking, and then Forbes did a profile of the work that I was doing. And then it turned out there were kind of iconoclastic people like me all around the world who on their own were starting to look into this. And over time, we started to find each other, and we formed a community. There were some really amazing French scientists who played a special role in making that possible. And I think we've seen in these last weeks that the work that so many of us, actually it's a few of us, but not a huge number, but maybe a couple dozen, few dozen of us have been doing over the last year, it's starting to bear fruit. And we've had some a lot of media attention to our claims. And it's not that we're saying we know it was a lab leak. What we're saying is we better have a full and unrestricted investigation into all of the hypotheses so we can figure out what happened.
So I did, as I mentioned, speak with Josh Rogan at the Washington Post, who has written a book about the deterioration of U.S.-Chinese relations and specifically about the COVID pandemic. He interviewed the U.S. diplomats who in 2017 visited the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And apparently they spoke, I think, with the bat lady there. And she even confessed that she was worried about the lack of our professionalism and professional people, because they sort of quickly put this building together. And this was their first level 4, BSL 4 lab in China. They built another one, I believe. Is anybody looking into some of the more obvious evidence trails that should be explored here, particularly the RATG-13, where several years back workers were cleaning bat guano in a cave in Yunnan province. Many got sick. I think two or three died. Those that didn't die were in hospital for the longest time, five, 6 months, I believe. And this was a coronavirus. And apparently lots and lots of virologists, including people from Wuhan, visited these patients and took samples. And I believe other samples were taken from this bat cave in Yunnan province. Isn't it possible that those samples, that the fact that they're in a human body for so long could have mutated? I mean,
So it's very possible, not necessarily that RATG-13 virus itself is the backbone of SARS-CoV-2, but there were multiple bat coronaviruses that were collected from that same cave and brought to the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And is it possible that that could be the backbone of SARS-CoV-2? Absolutely, yes. That's why we need a full investigation. That's why we need access to the records, the samples, the lab notes, all those things that the Chinese government has absolutely denied. So you asked who's looking into it. Well, our community of maybe a few dozen scientists and other experts, we're looking into all of those things extensively, aggressively, maybe even obsessively. I'll tell you who's not looking into it, at least so far, this joint committee of these international experts, International Expert Advisory Committee, organized by the WHO, but it's not the WHO itself, and their Chinese government counterparts. What those people are doing is trying to prevent exactly the kind of full investigation that we need. And that's why what we are saying is we need a full and unrestricted international scientific and forensic investigation examining all origin hypotheses with full access to all records, samples, and key personnel.
Well, Jamie Metzl, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Really my pleasure.
And again, I mean speaking with Jamie Metzl, who's a leading futurist, geopolitical expert, science fiction novelist, and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, who has served in the White House, the State Department, and the United Nations. In February of 2019, he was appointed to the World Health Organization's Expert Advisory Committee on Developing Global Standards for the Governance and Oversight of Human Genome Editing. And he's written A History of the Cambodian Genocide, an historical novel, The Depths of the Sea, and the genetic sci-fi thrillers Genesis Code and Eternal Sonata. And his latest book is Hacking Darwin, Genetic Engineering and the Future of Humanity. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right, another headline written down.